Let's go ahead and get started. So on Tuesday, we did a fair bit of review. And today, we're going to try to pick up the pace a little bit and finish talking about Unix process management in terms of how you create processes and the API that allows, for example, a parent process like a shell to control its children, and how open files are handled. This is actually very important if you're writing a shell, but also supports all kinds of other features. And then if time permits at the end, which I doubt, we'll talk about virtual memory. So last time we reviewed the quiz, we reviewed signals. I hope that helped make the lab easier. We briefly reviewed fork, and then we talked about exec. So exec, as you might recall, when you call exec, assuming it doesn't fail, the process that is calling exec turns into the new process. You'll recall that fork creates a copy of the process calling fork, and fork returns twice, once in the parent and once in the child. Exec, in the process that calls it, replaces that. So this is one of many different flavors of exec. They each have slightly different APIs that give you control over different things. This is an easy one to use, and you give it the path to the program that you want to start running, and you have to set up the args before you call exec so that you can pass in a pointer to the completed array of arguments, and that becomes the process's argv in main. So here's an example. And this is an example we looked at before where we're going to start running ls. So we have to set up the args here. And note this is a char star to something that's designated as an array, so it's actually a char star star. And here's the first char array, this string, another string, and you always have to have null as the last item in your argv. So now that we've set up the arguments, we can call exec, and the application we want to run is ls. We could specify an absolute path like we did here, or we could just specify the regular ls, and the shell will expand the path. I didn't say that right. So we're going to specify the absolute path here. And if you don't specify an absolute path on the command line in a shell, it's the shell that's expanding the path using that shell environment variable. If exec fails, then you want to check for an error. So exec should never return unless there's an error. If you get to this line here, exec failed. Just in this example, we threw in an exit. Again, shouldn't get to this exit. So a shell might run exactly this code. It might take in something on the command line that's how it would know that you want to run ls. Do fork, and then in the child, we'll set up the arguments and exec, and in the parent, we might now print out a new command line prompt. So what's happening in the kernel, we went through this example on Tuesday. We're actually in the child, in whatever process is running exec, we're going to actually allocate fresh memory down here to create space for the new program's program text, the copy of the program. Now we might share a copy if any other copy of that is running, but we certainly need new space for the program's data stack heap, right? So we're going to allocate new pages for that. Once we've got the new program ready to run, then we get rid of the old memory. We don't need it anymore. The reason we make a copy like this, rather than trying to make the modifications in place up here in the memory we already have, is that if we're trying to set up the stack for the new program, while we're running on the same stack, it's very hard to get that right. It's just much easier to set up a fresh stack, a fresh place in memory where you can put the new program stack, fresh heap. And then just before you're ready to actually start executing in the new program, you can release the old stack and the old heap, the old data segment. Then you set the program counter to the beginning of the new program and start running. So when you type something on the command line in the shell, like ls, and hit enter, this is what's happening. The shell is forking. The shell is going to exec ls. And then in exec, it's actually doing what I just described here. Yeah, there was a question.
Why go through the process of forking, making a new spot in memory, if you're just going to kill it and then exec it to run something else?
So we'll see why this is convenient when we look at redirection. Because the short answer is that after the fork, you have a copy of the shell running in the child. And the child can set up any redirection that's necessary without affecting the parent. And then when the child does the exec, that redirection persists across the exec. And so if you did ls angle bracket output.txt, you want the output of the ls command to go to this file output.txt instead of going to the screen. You would set up that redirection in the child before the exec. But that way you have the shell logic running in the child that can do that. And it won't sort of corrupt the status of the parent. and so to your point, there's really two questions. Your point was more about, I think, why create a full copy of the parent? And there's a trick that we'll talk about at the end of class if there's time called copy on write that allows us to avoid actually making the full copy of the child, since we're just going to get rid of it anyway. But more generally, why do we separate fork and exec? Other operating systems don't do this. Like Windows has a function called create process. And even the POSIX standard has something similar called POSIX spawn that combine fork and exec into one step. Just to confuse things further, Windows, because it does have a POSIX compliant Unix subsystem, also supports the separate fork and exec. But by default, if you're writing for Windows, you're going to use create process. And so what those things do is they set up the memory for the new process and exactly as needed for the new process, without this intermediate step of making a copy of the parent, like making a copy of the shell. The problem with this is that now you have to specify everything about the child in the single function call, create process or POSIX spawn. You have to describe redirection and all other kinds of properties of this new program that you're setting up. So what you can do in the shell in code that's running in the child, you now have to turn into arguments to these functions. So these functions end up taking a lot of arguments. But it does avoid this intermediate step of the fork. And so POSIX spawn, for example, here are some of the arguments that you have to set up. So there was a paper written a few years ago arguing that while fork was a great idea back when Unix was invented in the 70s, it's outlived its usefulness. And now the fact that you can fork and you have to support two copies makes design of other parts of the operating system messy. And it also observes that fork was created when we only had single-threaded code. We didn't think about multi-threading. So fork becomes more complicated when you have multi-threaded code. because if you're not careful, you could end up with different threads forking at different times and creating all kinds of chaos. And there is a potential security vulnerability too, that when you create the copy in fork and now you run another program, exec, if exec is not implemented exactly right, you could leak information from the parent into the new program that you're running with exec. Because remember, what exec does is it starts replacing the state with this new program. But if it doesn't do it exactly right, there's some information that could persist, and that would be an information leak. And this paper goes on at length. It's actually very entertaining reading. I encourage you to read it if you're interested. It's not that long. It's very accessible, but. This is by no means a settled debate in the operating system community. There are advocates of fork. And then for the redirection issue, we'll get to that in a little bit. But before we get to redirection, I want to talk about how one process can wait on another process. So any questions so far? So the POSIX process control API also gives us a function called waitPID and a related function called wait. So waitPID takes these three arguments: a PID of a process that you want to wait for, a status placeholder, so you're going to allocate a data structure and then pass a pointer and the OS will fill it in. You've probably noticed by now that this paradigm that you create something, then you pass a pointer into the function call, into the system call, the kernel fills in the contents, and then afterwards you have the information you want. That's a pretty common Unix, Linux paradigm. And then some options. So what this will do using your standard options is wait for the specified PID to complete. And when waitPID returns, you know that that process has completed and that the status field will have been filled in with information about how that process completed, like did it complete successfully or did it return an error code? And the options let you do things like say, I want to check and see if this PID is finished, and if not, just return without waiting for it. So that this is actually, tangent here. So you've maybe typed a command at the command line, put an ampersand at the end, and you get a command prompt back right away. Normally, when you run a program and hit enter without that ampersand, the shell just kind of hangs around until the program you just ran completes. So if you type ls enter or a.out enter, the shell just waits around for that program to complete before it gives you a new command prompt. So it's doing a waitPID. If you do the ampersand, now the shell is going to need to be able to do a waitPID without blocking, so that it can immediately give you a new command prompt while this other program that just got launched is running in the background. So that's a useful option for waitPID. But the basic idea here is that we can wait for a process. If we specify PID is equal to -1, we can wait for any child process. And then for the options, you know, often you just want to specify null or zero because you just want to use the default options. Wait is like waitPID, but waits for any child. So it's like wait is like waitPID, so wait just gets rid of the PID argument, and it'll wait for the first child to return. You can only wait on children. all right, I can't wait on your process, because that would be an information leak. So here's an example of how you'd use it. In a shell, you fork. In the child, you're doing whatever, maybe you're execing. But in the parent, you do wait PID, and that'll just wait until the child returns, and then you'll find out the status. Yes, question.
If you exec, does it wait until the exec process is finished, or just the child is turned or killed and the new program is started?
So when you exec, that process will keep the same PID. It just sort of transforms into a new identity. So it's like Clark Kent turning into Superman or something. It's still the same person. And so the parent can wait on the child, regardless of whether the child is doing an exec or not, and the child will, and whether the child has done an exec or not, whenever it finally completes, the wait PID will return. So for the recording, the question was, what happens if the child doesn't exec? Can you still wait on the process after it's exec? And the answer is yes. It's an important question.
Can the child wait on the parent?
Oh, geez. I don't believe the child can wait on the parent, but actually I would have to double check the man page on that. It doesn't really make sense, and I think there's a potential security leak there, but there's all kinds of crazy options, so I would want to double check that. Other questions? So to show this graphically, you've got the parent, it runs along, it forks, and the parent, you're waiting on presumably waiting on your child. The child does some stuff, may or may not exec. Eventually it exits, and when it exits, then the wait PID returns. Now the wait PID doesn't return immediately, right? So let's talk a little bit about exit. When a process runs exit as an actual system call saying I'm done, or if the process terminates, let's say it did a divide by zero, either way you're gonna go into the operating system and then end up in an exit routine that records some information about how that process exited. And it's going to hold that in the process table where the OS keeps some information about every process that's running. When a process calls exit or exits abnormally, the OS cleans up all the state for that process. It deallocates memory, closes open files, et cetera. But it keeps this entry in the process table until something waits for it. Now, if the child completes before the parent executes wait PID, that status information in the process table about the exited process just stays there until the wait PID happens. If the wait PID already happens, the kernel has a table where it keeps track of this, and it says, oh, okay, this process exited, this other process was waiting for it, so I will go ahead and make a note that this parent wait PID can return, and at some point in the future that will get scheduled, and the wait PID will actually return back to the user level mode in the parent and have the necessary information. So what happens if a process exits and no process ever waits for it? Amusingly enough, the OS terminology for this is a zombie. And that process just sits there holding that slot in the kernel's process table indefinitely, maybe until the system is rebooted, no other process waits on it. And if you actually print out a list of active processes, you can see that PID will be labeled as a zombie. So maybe elaborating the point too much, but this would be kind of what a possible sequence would be. So this is the child, this is the parent process. And then the exec launches a new function, and when it does an exit, then we provide the information to the parent. Any questions? So fork and exec are the kind of slightly weird abstractions in this API. Wait/wait_pid, they're pretty straightforward. Exit is hopefully pretty straightforward. So, we talked about these functions here, and let's see now how well you've kind of absorbed them and look at this example. So talk to your neighbors and see which answer or answers you think are correct. This code is a little convoluted. So it might take a minute to sort of digest what it's doing. Okay, let's go ahead and talk about this example. So how many people think it can be A? Okay, how many people think it can be B? And how many people think it can be C? And I'll assume that if you raised your hands for both A and C, you know that that covers E. So just going through this code here, first, a little orientation. So the echo here is taking these arguments, which were specified up here. Maybe I should actually draw that. Except, what we're going to do down here is replace this argument with extra of I. So we're going to fork twice, and in the first copy, we're going to put L1. And in the second copy, we're going to put L2. So we've got our parent process, child one, the args will be echo L1 null, then we'll have child two, and the args will be echo L2 and null. Everybody with me so far? So now, so what we're doing here is the parent's going along. For I equals zero, it does a fork. And so PIDs of zero will be either zero, if you're the child, or the PID of child one, if you're the parent. And then if you're the child, then you do this argument replacement, and your argument here will be L1. And then you exec, and all echo does is echo its arguments and print it to the screen. So echo args will take the first thing on the command line after the program name and anything else that's there too. It'll just take that and echo it to the screen. So child one is going to echo and child two is going to echo L2. So in this loop, we wrap around, we repeat this process for another child, and each of the children do this echo, so we can get L1 and L2, and an astute observer may have noticed that there should be a new line here. We kind of left that off. Or C, because the children can run in either order. Right? Just because we fork them in a certain order doesn't mean that that's the order in which they actually get around to doing the exec and running the echo. This context switching can happen at any time. So that means that the correct answer is this. So the child runs, does one echo. Another child runs, does one echo, and then we're done. There's this extra L2 stuck on the end. Sorry, maybe that's a little scrunched and the formatting is a little, makes it a little hard to differentiate. Do people feel like they understand now what this program does and why the answers are A and C? Being able to reason through this is really helpful in understanding how these different things work. Yes?
So I understand the first four loop, but what's just the second four loop with the late PID?
Okay, so we didn't cover that. So so let's follow the path of the parent. So the parent, I'll put here in green. It's going to do this for loop twice and record the PIDs of the fork children. So but this code here in the if statement is not executed by the parent, right? Because it's guarded with this if PID equals zero. So all the parent does is do a fork, capture the PID, do another fork, capture the PID, and then come down here. The children should never get to this code because they're doing an exec. If the children get to this code, exec failed, and we really should have error handling in here, but if we put error handling in every example, the slides get long. So like in these slides and in the quiz, by the way, when you see that error handling isn't there where it really ought to be, it's just to keep the code snippet from being too long. And so the parent gets down here, and it's going to wait on child zero. I should actually have called this. I should really probably have called this child zero and child one because, you know, I starts as zero. So it's going to wait on these two children. And after both children have completed, then the parent will continue on beyond there. So there was a question over here, and then I'll get to you.
Is there a situation where child one would finish running quickly, and then child zero would take a long time, and then child one would then be having to be reassigned to a different process, and then the parent would wait on that?
So the it's an astute question. So the question was, suppose child one, let's just imagine it has PID one for convenience, completes, and it's done. And now something else somewhere in the system does a fork and creates a new process. Could that new process be allocated that PID that child one was using? And now PID one refers to something completely separate. And the answer is no, because it will be a zombie until something waits for it. So a PID doesn't go away and get recycled until it's been waited upon and its status has been collected. Until it's been waited upon, it's just a zombie. And unlike zombies in the movies, it doesn't do anything. It just sits there. It's a corpse, if you'll pardon the bad pun about zombies. So there's a question back here.
Yeah, so if child PIDs are always zero, then how will wait PID know which child to wait for since they can both have a PID of zero?
So the question was about child PIDs being zero. So remember, after a fork, return value from fork is zero in the child. But in the parent, what this code here is doing is getting the actual PID. So the fork returns zero only in the child, but it returns the child's actual PID in the parent. Yes? So the question was, how does the parent get the two different child PIDs? You mean this one? So the trick here is that we have an array here of PIDs. And so the parent, when I is zero, is putting the first fork child PID in PIDs of zero. And then we go around the loop, and the parent is going to skip over this if statement because the condition doesn't apply to the parent. And the parent will come back up here and increment I. Now I is one. And then PIDs of one will now be the PID of the second fork. So we have PIDs and this will be child zero, and this will be child one's PID. Did that answer your question? So we've just created multiple spots where we can record a sequence of PIDs by creating an array. And so before we fork each time, we're incrementing I. So we're moving along in this array here. So if we were going to fork 10 children, we'd need a PID array of 10 slots. So I could change my loop bound here from I less than 2 to I less than whatever I want and create that many children. And I'd have to make this array correspondingly sized. So if I'm going to fork 10 children and my I loop bound is going to be 10, then I would need my PID array to have 10 slots. And that way, as I increment I, each time I'm capturing the return value from fork and putting it in PIDs of I. And you'll notice here in the child that when the child is checking its PID, it's checking the corresponding entry. So the first fork, I is 0, so child 0 is checking PIDs of 0 and getting whatever PID was there. And then we loop around and I becomes 1, we do another fork, and now this next child is capturing the value here for PIDs sub 1 and checking that. So it's only checking its own PID. And we can chat later if you have further questions. Other questions about this? Yes?
Sorry, do you mind explaining again, like, the purpose of the for loop at the end of the
PID? So the question was about this for loop here. We need to loop here because we have multiple children to wait for. And wait PID will only return once for the specified PID. So we have two child processes and two child PIDs, so we have to do a wait PID on each of them. And so I could have just hard-coded two copies of wait PID without a for loop, but keeping with the for loop idiom here, I also have to have a for loop to wait the corresponding number of times.
So it's not like affecting the output anyway, just waiting for the
child process. That's right. You'll notice that there's no printfs down here. In fact, there's no printfs or echoes or any other kind of output anywhere except in this child code here. And by the way, a slide like this is why we post a clean version of the slides as well as I post the annotated version. I think some students like to be able to look at the annotated version. But if you're just going back and reviewing for the exam and looking at this slide with my scribbles all over the place, good luck. Okay, so let's look at another exercise. This is a slightly different version of what we just did. So now talk to your neighbors and think about what the output will be. This one's even a little more mind-bending than the previous one, but you'll see some similarity.
Exactly. turns it into process at the
Okay. So forgive me for interrupting, but I want to make sure we have time to get to redirection. I also want to call your attention to this over here, since the formatting maybe was a little distracting on the last slide. There are four things that get printed here for all the examples. So how many people think it's A? Okay, how many people think B is a possible answer? How many people think C? And how many people think D? Okay, so the correct answer here is E. It's A, B, and C, not D. And I'll explain a little more in the next, I just moved to the next slide. So why? Well, first let me observe that we have two children. Whoops, I meant to use my... We have two children here that get forked, just like in the last example. We don't have any argument replacement here. The children are going to print zero. We have two children that are doing echo, and assuming the execs don't fail, we should see two zeros on the output somewhere, which we see in all the examples. Now, the parent is going to print one after it forks the two children, but we don't know what the execution order is. And then the parent is going to print two after it's completed waiting for both its children. That's why D is not a valid answer, because we only print two here after the parent has completed waiting for both its children. But if it's completed waiting for both of its children to exit, then there can't be one of these children printing zero after the wait PIDs, because we can't print two until both children are done. So there can't be a children still running and printing zero. Question? So that's the answer here in a nutshell. I can elaborate, but any questions? Yeah.
So I was just wondering about just how you would format this in general. Is it more common to fork and run exec on all the children and then wait for all of the processes at the end? Or would it be better to fork, run exec, and then wait for single processes as you go through a program? Does that make sense?
So the question was, what's a more common paradigm? To basically have a pair of fork, exec, wait, that's a triplet, and then do this again, or fork a bunch of stuff, and then later wait for them in a loop. And I can't really give you a simple answer because it really depends on what you're trying to do. In the common shell example, the shell is waiting for command line input, and you hit enter. And the shell reads that, and assuming that the command isn't something like exit, and there's an actual thing that it should launch, it will do a fork, and in the child it will do an exec, and in the parent it'll wait for that child to complete. And then it'll print out a new command line and wait for input and so on. Now the other paradigm I said is when you use the ampersand to run the command in the background. So if I type a command like ls and do ampersand, and I actually don't, who does this for ls? But let's say I've launched a find command that's going to search my whole directory for a file that has something. That could take a while. So I might put an ampersand and do some other stuff. And in that case, the parent is going to do the fork, and then the child will exec the same command. The ampersand gets stripped off by the shell. And then the shell will do a version of wait PID that's non-blocking. It basically says, has anything exited yet? Or has this child exited yet? It actually probably uses wait, which will check if any, because I might launch a bunch of commands in the background. So it'll do wait with the option to be non-blocking, and then while there's anything pending in the background, every time it runs a command, it'll do a wait to see if anything's finished. Now, if you were doing some kind of parallel processing where you launch a bunch of child processes with the idea that they'll run on different cores and they'll be doing sort of some kind of collaborative work, maybe using a shared memory segment like you did in lab, then I would probably fork my N children. And then once all the shared work is done, then I would do a loop where I wait for all of my N children. And to be sure that all the N children are done, I have to have a way to know that. And so you could do that by using signals, or there's a mechanism called a barrier that allows a bunch of programs to basically all reach a common point, which we call a barrier, and none of them can move past until your N partner processes or threads have finished and executed the barrier. Any other questions about this? Yes. You're asking about the F flush here. And so the F flush is there because with streams, which is what you're using with the printf function, there's buffering that happens. So the printf and related functions, those, that group of function calls, they don't just immediately write stuff to the screen or to the file. They'll buffer a certain amount of output and then write it out as a batch. So when you do the system call write and give it a buffer to some text, that will happen before the write call returns. It'll happen, it'll get pushed out to the specified destination as soon as possible. But printf and other functions like that might accumulate output over multiple printf calls before they actually write it to the screen or to the file. So if we want to make sure that the one there gets printed out before the wait PIDs and doesn't get buffered and sort of lumped in with the two, and that could affect the interleaving of these different processes, I do the F flush. Other questions? Yes. The question is, when you fork the two children, are all three processes running concurrently? Probably yes. It's sort of arbitrary when they might run and complete. So kind of any interleaving is possible. The parent could run first and get all the way down to the wait PID before the fork children do anything. Or your first fork child could run right away and complete before the parent gets to resume running and do another fork. So kind of any possible interleaving of these processes is possible, including that one of the fork children forks and runs to completion and exits and becomes a zombie before anything else happens. Okay, so we should probably move on and talk about redirection. So POSIX-compliant shells, that's what we're usually talking about when we talk about the command line that you interact with. But actually, a GUI is a shell, too. We'll talk about that in a minute. But POSIX command line features, POSIX compliant shells have to support some features. So the shell will support path expansion. So if you have a path variable set in your environment, it's actually the shell that has this these environment variables. And the shell remembers that what your path is. It just keeps that path variable stored in memory. And anytime you run a command, if you don't specify an absolute path name like /bin/ls, if you just type ls, it says, okay, there's no path here. Let me check the path variable and check each of the directories in the path variable. So path might be /bin, /user/bin. And it will check each of those directories for LS, and it'll pick the first one that it finds. So if you have a command LS that's executable in slash bin, and you also have a version of LS in slash user slash bin, it'll pick the first one that it finds. The point being that the shell does this path expansion. You don't always have to type the absolute path name. By default, when a shell is configured, the current directory is typically not in the path, and you have to add it. That's why if you type a.out after you've compiled something and expect it to run and it fails, it's probably because the path doesn't include your current working directory. You can also, I talked about running in the background. You can do redirection, which you've probably used at some point in your career. So the greater than sign says, I want the output of this program to go to whatever the destination is. And then the less than means I want to read input from that destination, from that source. And you can also set up pipelines. So I might, for example, run some program that generates output and run it through some filter that only will then print out the lines that match the filter. So an example of this might be I might search for key in some log file. And with grep, I can either specify log file as an argument, or just for fun, I could redirect to standard in. And then I might run this through a filter called unique, which is a program that just throws away lines that are redundant. And then I might sort it. And then I'm running out of space here. I might run it through the command head, which will print out the first n lines of the result. So what this pipeline will do is search this log file for any lines that have the word key. Then the output of that will go through unique, which will throw away lines that are redundant. Then I can sort those, and then head by default prints out the first 10 lines. That's an example of a command line pipeline. So, any questions so far? Let's see, we covered that. So, I've mentioned in the kernel that there's a process table. That each of these is a struct process info, and that contains the PID, etc., and it also contains a struct open file description table. Of some size. And so in the state that the kernel is keeping about every process, there's this table. And it's size of how many PIDs are possible with a PID T. And for each entry in that array, there's some fields. And the fields actually also include a place to capture the context of the process when you context switch it. So there's a place there to capture the register values when you're switching that process off the CPU. And then there's this struct that is another table. So we have a nested table that contains information about all the files that the process has open. And these file descriptors aren't actually just for files. They're for any entity that you might be reading from or writing to. So this could be standard in, standard out, files, network sockets, pipes, and so on and so forth. And so the file descriptor that you get when you open something is an index into this array. And so with system calls like read or write, when you specify an FD, you're giving it an index into this table. So if you're using standard io.h and you're using commands like printf, printf does not take an FD. Printf takes something called a files pointer. That is not a file descriptor, that's a struct. And inside that struct, you have the file descriptor, and you also have this buffer that I mentioned, and maybe some other state. So there are some file descriptors that are special. By convention, this is part of the POSIX standard, file descriptor number 0 is the standard input. File descriptor 1 is the standard output. File descriptor 2 is what's called the standard error. And we often abbreviate these as follows, and you can actually find out what the numbers are. I said it on the slide, but you could go look in this Unix standard.h and look at these definitions and find out what those numbers are. But standard error also by default is directed to the screen, but it allows you to separate regular program output from error messages. And then if you want to redirect, you can redirect an application's regular output differently than its error output. So for example, I might redirect standard out to a file, but leave standard error showing on the screen. So that way, as the program is running and generating output and putting it in this file that I redirected to, I still see the error messages on the screen. By default, the standard in is coming from the keyboard. So by default, the standard out and the standard error go to the same place, and their output will be commingled. Now, when you do an open, you don't get to choose what number file descriptor is assigned. I'll just say open assigns lowest number unused file descriptor slot. So you get a file descriptor when you open a file for reading, for writing. Open is actually being called inside the fopen standard IO API. You also get a file descriptor, as you saw in lab, when you set up a shared memory segment. When you open a network socket, and when you open a pipe. And then you can close the file descriptor with the close system call, and that deallocates that array index. Deallocating an array index doesn't necessarily close the underlying file for use if other file descriptors have the same file open. And it's only if the last pointer to an open file is closed that we actually close the file. So let's see how redirection works. So let's see here. So before I get into that, it's important to remember that when we do a fork, Fork copies open FDs, and exec by default preserves them. So you can give an option to exec that'll say close any open files. But unless you specify that special option, open files stay open across an exec. So you can see here that when the fork makes the copy, it preserved the open files. And that way a child and a parent would both share access to the keyboard depending on who's running, and both be able to print to the screen. And if I need to redirect, let's see the idiom here. So supposing I'm a shell and I want to read, you're running a command and you want to redirect input or output. So I'm going to fork the child and I'm going to set up the redirection in the child so that that child processes input or output is redirected. But obviously you don't want to do this for the parent shell. If the parent shell input is redirected, you can't type commands anymore. And if the parent shell output is redirected, then you can't put the command line on the screen anymore because the shell's output is going somewhere. So you do all the redirection in the child. So you see here in the parent, we fork the child and ignore the black text. The parent just waits on the child. In the child, when we know that it's the child because PID is zero, that's where we open the new files and implement the redirection. So how do we do that? We have an API a system call that will do this for us by duplicating a file descriptor. So in an example like this, first we have to open output.txt for writing and we'll get a new file descriptor. If we didn't have any other open files, that new file descriptor would be 3 because open gives you the lowest numbered file descriptor. 0, 1, and 2 are already open for standard in, standard out, and standard error. And now we can dup 2. Let me catch up in my notes here. So the way this would look is I had this on the slide already. So here's the syntax for dup2. The first argument is, you can think of this as the source, and this is the destination. What that will do is close standard out, and then copy the information from slot 3 into slot 1. So when you type in your program that you want to write or printf or whatever to standard out, that is sort of hardwired to go to slot 1 in your file descriptor table, and it'll use whatever is there. So if you've closed the default standard out that points to the screen and replaced that slot with a pointer to this file that's open, now writing to standard out goes to that file. Because standard out is just a name for slot 1, whatever is in there. So we'll use whatever is in that slot. So here's an example. We open output.txt, and here, you know, you should check for errors. Now we copy this FD into the standard out. And now we can close the original file descriptor, but that doesn't close, that doesn't get rid of output, our access to output.txt. So what's happened here is that there's a system open file table. And here's our per process file descriptor table. And when we start out, this points to the keyboard, this points to the screen, two points to the screen, and then we open output.txt, and what open does, for example, is assign file descriptor 3, and now the dup makes a copy and we get rid of this, and now we have two pointers to output.txt. And then when we close this, note that we still have this pointer active in the out, in the standard out slot. So now, when we do this printf here, printf by default goes to standard out. Standard out is pointing to output.txt. Everybody with me? So when you fork, a child inherits those file pointers. And inside the fork, what it's actually doing is literally going, doing a loop and copying the child, the parent file descriptors into the child file descriptor table. So pipes are a special kind of file that we can create with the pipe system call, like you see up here, and it returns an array of two file descriptors. So remember in my command pipeline example, I want to send data, I want to send output from the left-hand side of the pipe to the right-hand side of the pipe. So I have a write end and a read end of the pipe. And this is slightly backwards from intuition. The read end is zero, even though in my command pipeline, like ls minus a grep foo, the read end is over here on the pipeline. And what we're actually doing is setting up a buffer in kernel memory where ls writes to it and grep reads from it. And we're connecting the standard out of ls and the standard in of grep. And so now we can write to the right end of the pipe and read from the read end of the pipe. So here's an example in use. We call pipe. We provided this pre-allocated array of two pipe FDs that are uninitialized, and they get filled in by the pipe command. And when they're filled in and the pipe command returns without an error, pipe FD of 0 is the read end and pipe FD of 1 is the write end. And that's the information in the kernel that actually allow you to sort of refer to this buffer in memory. And now I can fork, and in the child, I can close the read end. In this example, we have child, weirdly, writing to the parent. It's a convoluted example just to illustrate a point. So the child can close its copy of the read pipe, because remember, after the fork, the child and the parent have the same file descriptor. So the child inherits the pipe FD structure from the parent, already filled in. So both the parent and the child have pipe FD pointing to the read and the write ends of the pipe. But the child only needs one end. So it's going to close the read end because it's going to write to this pipe. And the parent is going to close the write end because it's going to read from the pipe. So I kind of said everything that's on these slides, but you should close the unused pipe descriptors. If you exit like the child here does, everything gets closed for you. So that's why the child doesn't have to do this. So let's see a real example with a pipeline, and that'll be a good place to stop. So we want to set up this command pipeline. So we set up a pipe FD, and then we fork, and we capture the PID in a variable that we'll call lspid. In a real shell, we don't know what commands are being specified. This is illustrative. So now after the fork, if in the child, or in the first child, which will be ls, we're going to do dup to copy the read end of the pipeline. Sorry, to copy the write end of the pipeline. So after this, now standard out is going into the write end of the pipeline. So now we'll close both of these file descriptors in the child. This does not affect the parent and it does not affect the other children. Because what's left is we only have access to the right end of the pipe and it's attached to standard out. And then we can exec ls, and ls's output will go into the right end of the pipe. Now we're going to fork again. We're going to do the same thing, except here we're in the second child, which is grep, and we're copying the read end of the pipe to standard in. And then we close the pipe FDs because we don't want extra file descriptors hanging around. And we can exec grep and it will read from the read end of the pipe. So now the output of ls is going into the pipe, the input of grep is coming from the read end of the pipe. An important point here is that the pipe will not cease to exist until the process writing to it sends end of file. And this will not happen if there are extra copies of the file descriptors that are opened. That's why you have to close unused file descriptors. That's why we have these close things here. So pictorially, you can see this happening here. We do the open, that gives us file descriptor 3. We redirect that to standard in. Now we can close 3 and 4. Same up here, we redirect 4 to standard out, we can close 3 and 4. The parent isn't using either copy of the pipe, so it needs to close those. And that is a good stopping point. So I will leave this slide in the slide deck that I post so that you can look at this example. I just want to point out this example has a bug. Thanks, everyone.